All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the New Glarus Brewing Podcast with Dan Carey. As always, my name is Scott May, and today we're going to be talking sort of this kind of the seasonality of beer and how the calendar sort of reflects that in the styles of beer. We are, well, 10 days into November here in Wisconsin, although it is 72 degrees here today. How are you feeling, Dan?
A little bit warm, uncomfortable in that way, but everything is good.
Yeah, I walked out my my door this morning, and the cement was doing that thing where it's just like kind of humidity moisture, like it hadn't rained and it was already 65 degrees, and it legitimately felt like April.
Yeah, I thought maybe it had rained last night. It's not normal. I think us Wisconsinites, we expect cold weather in the fall, so it's kind of disconcerting.
Yeah, well, it's supposed to snow tonight and be 30 tomorrow.
There,
so welcome to the upper Midwest, right?
Yeah, right. If you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes.
Exactly. So we are deep into November, getting deep into November now. And with that, you might start noticing some, you know, different trends on your beer shelf. So I know for us here at New Glarus, we're having a couple beers, one that is out there and one that is probably, is as you're hearing this, going to be hitting the shelves. But for you, Dan, as a brewer, when you start getting towards the end of summer, what do you start thinking about as far as kind of beers you want to drink or kind of beers you want to make or kind of beers you think the public would want?
Well, you know, the thing is when we talk about fall beers, we're really actually now talking about fall 2023 beers because we have to get raw materials. We have to prepare our schedule. We have to make certain that we have our procedure squared away. And that takes time, especially nowadays, getting raw materials. So we're thinking about, actually, I'm thinking about a beer that we'll see out in the market 8 or 9 months from now. But in general, of course, obviously, when fall's coming around, I'm thinking about Oktoberfest beers and amber beers and stouts, particularly when the snow starts to fall.
Yeah, yeah. And with that comes sort of higher gravity beers, darker beers, more roasty beers. And one of my favorite beers, and going back to when it was a year round, is Fat Squirrel. And whenever I see that show up on the brewing schedule, I get really, really excited. And I feel like, must have been 7-8 years ago now where sort of Nut Brown Ales were having a real moment, right?
Yeah, this beer, Fat Squirrel, has been made, I believe it's been made for about 20 years now,
yeah.
on off. And there's really two types of nut brown ales. There's the English style, and then there's the North American style. And I really love English beer. We don't make a lot of English style beers, but I think the English are great brewers. They have great malt, great hops, and the beers are eminently drinkable. The our nut brown ale leans more towards that tradition than the North American tradition. You know, the first nut brown ale in United States that was made of the American style beers was Pete's Wicked Ale. Started in 1986. And actually, it's kind of funny, Deb and I went to the brewery where it was being made and met Pete Schlossberg and tasted the beer. And he's a great brewer, a lot of fun, great beer. But that style is a more assertive, more hop-forward. Obviously, in the American tradition, beers are generally more hop-forward, more higher alcohol than the European tradition. But Our idea for Fat Squirrel was to make more of an English tradition. Certainly, we were inspired by Newcastle. When this beer came out, that Newcastle Brown Ale was a big beer, and it's gone through a lot of changes. I believe now it's made in Holland. I don't think it's really made in Newcastle, although I could be wrong about that. And of course, it's made by Lagunitas in Chicago and out in California. And the beer has, it's a great beer, but the beer has changed compared to what I thought it was back in those days. And if you look at that beer and maybe Nut Brown Ale from Sam Smith, those are more of the type of beer that we want to make, although our Fat Squirrel is a much higher gravity than Newcastle is. It's a it's about a little over 14 degrees Plato, which clocks in at a little over 6.4% alcohol.
Wow, I would that actually blows my mind. I would never guess that out of Fat Squirrel drink. Like, because when I drink Fat Squirrel, I'm just like going back in my sort of memory bank of it. And it's like, I would never associate and be like, wow, that's probably higher alcohol than say like, a Spotted Cow even or something like that. Like, so that's really interesting to me.
Well, it is. There's a lot of caramel malt in it. It's mainly all a Wisconsin malt from Breese Malting, and it's a lot of caramel malt and some Victory malt, and of course some dark malt in it. So it does have a very rich character to it. And we wanted the beer to be sort of a nice, sweet, fall beer, kind of a dark brown color, and really, really a assertively malty beer.
Yeah. Yeah, whereas as you're saying, sort of the American take on a lot of traditional, like either English or German beer, seems to be sort of up the hop yeah, character, yeah, yeah. up always, the assertiveness a little bit.
No matter how many hops you add, you can always fit more in.
You can always, did you
which
try
is not
dry,
a bad ethos.
Did you try dry hopping it too?
Yeah, exactly. It's not a bad ethos, but it's not the style we were going for in this beer.
Well, yeah, and I talking to you about this sort of stuff and kind of going back into your recipe book and hearing you just explain where you were coming from on that stuff. And then thinking about something like the Nut Brown Ale, which I'm glad you brought up Newcastle, because when I was probably like 21 or 22 and I was a short order cook, for some reason that was like, I got it stuck in my head that was a fancy beer. Yeah. Like at the end of my shift, I was like,
well, it was a clear bottle.
Yeah, it's a clear bottle.
Came from a place a long way away. So
yeah,
that makes
fancy.
It fancy.
You know, it's like English. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So after my shift, it'd always be like, I'll have a Newcastle.
Well, it's an easy drinking. It was and is an easy drinking beer.
Yeah. And the reason I guess I'm bringing it or kind of reemphasizing it is because it seems like you've put a lot of thought into this character for Fat Squirrel that's, you know, making it as sort of smooth roasted malty as possible and making it really easy on the palate. So when you were designing that recipe, did you find that a particularly hard target to hit?
Yes.
Or, yeah.
Yes. It was very hard to make a beer that had a strong caramel malt flavor and a strong roasted malt flavor without being acrid. That was quite a balancing act because we wanted the beer to be a little bit sweet, a little bit rich, but still be drinkable. And that's threading the needle between bitterness and astringency, bitterness from the hops, astringency from the roasted malt, and the sweetness from the base malt, the caramel malt, coupled with the fruitiness from the yeast to try to get that balance so that then the beer is harmoniously drinkable. It's not so easy. This beer kind of is, it's not really a English beer because frankly we're not an English brewery, mm-hmm. and we're using American malt, and we're kind of, as I said in previous interviews with you, that this was our own beer, our own way.
Well, yeah, and that's really cool. And one of the things that strikes me particularly about Fat Squirrel is, and I kind of touched on it a little in the when we were talking in the intro to this, is beer styles have moments in America, right? Like,
sure,
the Nut Brown Ale has a moment, pale ales have a moment, stouts have a moment, big, huge beers get their moment. So when Fat Squirrel first comes out, it comes out sort of predating that moment for Nut Brown Ales, but finds its niche or finds its audience very quickly within that moment. But then it sort of circles around and it goes back down to like a seasonal offering. When you're making that decision, does that affect you as like the recipe writer who's clearly babied this thing from inception?
Well, really as a business person, in addition to being a brewer, the beer has to be economically feasible.
Yeah.
And we sell our beer through wholesalers. And when we started the brewery in 93, our typical wholesaler might have had five or six different beers that they were selling. And mm-hmm. then we came along. Now, many of the wholesalers have hundreds of beers to choose from. So, as we funnel through that gauntlet of the wholesale to retail, we have to continue to focus a message to the wholesalers. And if we have too many brands, too many options, it becomes scattered mm-hmm. because the wholesalers need to be given directive. They need to be given, they need to understand what their goals are, and that can't be fragmented. If we have too many brands, it becomes difficult. So by putting some of these beers into groups of seasonal beers so that we have a, you know, spring, summer, fall, and winter beer, that becomes more or less a single brand. That's seasonal number one, for yeah. example. And then maybe we'll have seasonal number two. And that becomes much easier to communicate with wholesalers, because really in brewing, package brewing, the bottleneck is access to market. Mm-hmm. You can have the best beer in the world, but if you don't have proper communication with your wholesalers, it becomes very difficult to get that on the shelves. And the shelves are very saturated.
Yeah. Yeah, just walking down the beer aisle in your local grocery store.
Yeah, right.
You can see how many options, I guess, there just kind of are out there now. So,
right.
So,
right.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Now, with the sort of the seasonality of, you know, with fall comes your sort of darker, more caramely beers. Everyone's sort of getting in the spirit of bonfires and marshmallow sure, roasting sure. and all that stuff. But what I have noticed is as people are starting to prepare for, you know, that hard set in of winter, and here in Wisconsin, we certainly get our fair share of those colds.
Deb says it keeps the whiners out.
Well, yeah, it certainly does. Well, I don't know if I go bragging that we have 75 November 10th, but you see sort of alcohol content start to rise over the winter too.
Right.
And you get this very rich tradition of, you know, winter warmers and things like that. And, you know, I think it was episode 2, we were talking about wheat beers, and you had put out a Doppelbach around this time last year, which was
a lager.
One of my absolute favorite beers, in Gyrator. And that inspired you to do a Weizen version of that, which is, I think, dropping today when this episode comes out. It should be dropping. Search your beer finder for it. So can you tell me a little bit? I have not tried it yet. So can you tell me a little bit about the Weizen Doppelbach?
It's a beer that's about 8% alcohol, okay. more or less, about 18.5 degrees Plato, original gravity. It's a strong, dark beer made with Bavarian Hefeweiss yeast. So we, as people that know our brewery, know that we make a whole bunch of different types of wheat beers. Like right now, we have Bubbler out, which is an easier drinking, pale Weiss beer. But this was a beer that I've always wanted to make, and Gyrator was very successful for us last year, and so we want to come up with another strong beer. I mentioned that previous podcast, but the idea was to come up with a different strong beer, and we've made lots of Weiss beers. We understand how to brew Weiss beer, and so this is a traditional Bavarian style Weiss beer. I'm friends with the brewmaster at Schneider. He's retired now, but we used to talk from time to time about beer. And in fact, he had helped me when we put our cellar together with our open top fermenters. So this is a very traditional Weiss beer. It's a double decoction mash, which I think in the United States is relatively rare. I think there are a few people that do single decoctions, but as I said before, double decoction is a superior way to make beer. It is, it's bottle fermented, so it's naturally carbonated in the bottle in the traditional way. It's a very traditional Weiss beer yeast that has a balance of the kind of fruity banana, with a cinnamon and clove character. Made with 60% dark malted wheat. Dark is what we would call in America. We call it Munich malt, but in Germany they call it dark malt wheat.
So is, and this will be thumbprint, right?
It is. Let me look here. It is. Yeah, it's thumbprint.
Nice.
Four packs.
So I'm glad you brought up Schneider, because I love going into Schneider when I'm in Munich and going to their little restaurant. And,
On Imtal.
Yeah. And that's really cool that you have that connection with, you know, these just sort of giants in their field to come talk you.
It's a small industry. It's a small industry.
But one of my favorite beers they make, and it's always a treat for me, you know, as a nightcap, is their Schneider Eisbach. Because you just don't really see that here. And there's some history with you and Eisbachs.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you?
That sounds bad, doesn't it? There's some history.
There's some spotted history. Yeah, right. No, but you had one of the first Eisbachs in America at some point, right?
Yeah, I think we made it for the Symposium Eisbach, and I think it was maybe 1999. We made it for the Craft Brewers Conference when it was in Milwaukee, and then we did it one other time. So this will be our third Eisbach that we've made, and it's right now it's in we have a cooler where we store fruit and hops, and it's at basically 0 degrees Fahrenheit. So we took some of this double Dunkelweizen beer and we put it in portable tanks inside that cooler, and right now we're slowly inching our way up from 8% alcohol up to above 10, maybe 11-12%. We'll see how it goes.
If we weren't clear, so you're taking this Weizen Dunkel Doppelbach, and you're freezing it down and making a new Eisbach out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really cool. And we were talking before this, that's only going to be here though, right?
Yeah,
that's not going out to distribution.
It's going to be, it's just for fun. It's like 10 barrels and we'll sell it out of our gift shop.
Oh,
part of our what we call our R&D series. You know, obviously it's kind of tongue in cheek research and development, but it also means Randy and Dan for myself and Randy Teal.
That's really cool. I'm actually very, very excited about that. I can't wait till I can walk down there and be like, is it around you?
Well, a sample came in the lab this morning and to see where we're currently at on alcohol concentration. It's tasting pretty good.
Good, good.
Still need some time though.
So as we get going into winter, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about just this concept of sort of the seasonality of beer. And, you know, some of my favorites that you've done were Winter Warmer, which I believe was a Scotch ale that came out a couple years in a row. There was a Spiced Ale. Of course, Gyrator falls into this.
Dog Bolter was the other, or what was it called? No, Tailwagger.
Tailwagger.
Dog Bolter was another. That was a beer from Australia. No, Tailwagger.
So when you start designing, you know, a beer that's going to be darker or have a higher gravity, and you're very well known for your balance and drinkability within this industry. So when you start talking about taking up one aspect of a beer sort of out of whack of the others, how does that affect you when you're writing a recipe, when you're ultimately aiming at a goal of like, you know, I want to have just not one element overtaking any of it and having this be a very balanced and drinkable experience?
Yeah, there's been a lot of written about that, how to do that, and really a lot of what's written, a lot of what's known comes from the home brewing literature. There's a lot of clever home brewers that have done a lot of work on that, and I think the idea is that when you increase the amount of stuff in your beer, the amount of malt, so that you increase the alcohol, you really don't want to take your specialty malts up. So if you're using caramel malts or Munich malts or whatever, you don't want to double them. If you have a double strength beer, you want to pretty much leave them where they were and just increase your pale malt. And if you are making, say, a Belgian style beer that has the Belgians would say a higher digestibility, which would mean the use of sugar or candy sugar or the like, you could use sugar to boost up the alcohol. But it's a dangerous game because sometimes beer can be sort of hot and solventy, and that's a dangerous that's a hard thing to hit, so that the beer is harmonious and fruity and has yeast character, but is not not like drinking a paint thinner.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes with the, you know, with the higher gravity stouts can be syrupy and things like that. And
so it's yeah,
all stuff to try to think through, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, it depends on what your goal is. If you want to make a lot of the imperial stouts are somewhat syrupy,
yeah,
alcoholic and syrupy, full bodied, sweet. And I think people like that.
Yeah.
We made a bourbon barrel stout last year that was released in our R&D program. And I tried to have a higher attenuation so that it wasn't syrupy, so that it was much more drinkable. I tend to hope that the beers have higher drinkability. So there may be, you know, it's more than just the impact of the first sip, but how do you feel after a pint?
Yeah.
And that requires more of a subtlety of character.
So, you know, as we're sort of talking through the seasonality of beer, and we've sort of touched on styles get, you know, their moment right now, like double IPAs are continuing to have their moment. Pastry stouts are having their moment. High gravity beers are having their moment. And you're seeing sort of these flagship beers that are within these styles. So you're getting these styles sort of year round. And do you find, you know, you sort of lose something in the traditional seasonal change of things as a certain beer style sort of takes over the craft beer landscape?
You know, Scott, I would really not be able to offer an educated opinion on that because frankly, I don't think I've ever gone into a liquor store and bought a pastry stout. It's just, it's not something that I would buy.
Yeah.
So, and I think that such beers are, they get some street cred. I think if you have a tap room, I think that such a beer is fun and people will try it when they're there just for fun. Just like you would have a, you know, indulgent dessert at a restaurant.
Yeah.
But I don't think that those types of beers have they have the follow through as far as people buying them. I mean, I don't think hundreds of thousands of barrels of such beer are actually being produced. I think they're more image makers.
Gotcha.
And, but I, you know, I'm old. I don't know. Maybe other people are drinking those types of beers. So I'm sorry, I can't really say.
No, but I think that's a good assessment of, you know, like having a dessert or having something sort of special after the meal of like, okay, yeah, I'll take, you know, a pour from a large bottle of that.
And share it.
Yeah. About suffice. Yeah. I think that's a perfect answer. Yeah. I think you got your finger right on the pulse there.
But I, obviously in this modern age, IPAs are certainly king.
Yeah.
A lot of breweries have reinvented themselves to be IPA breweries, and a lot of tap rooms, of course, have multiple IPAs, rotating IPAs, and certainly they have struck a chord with customers.
Yeah, well, and the reason I was asking was mostly because I'm just such a distracted person. I like having sort of the seasonal
squirrel.
Yeah, sort of the seasonal change of things. Okay, this is grounding me now. We're getting our lighter stuff into our IPAs and our session stuff. And then, okay, now we're getting into our darker, maltier,
yeah, that's why, stuff. Like we make a beer totally naked, which is an American style. I've talked about it before, American style, lager beer. And, sometimes people that really like that beer say you should make that all year round. And Deb says, no, it's a summer beer you look forward to drink in the summer. So there's a lot to be said for, you know, in the summer, I'm going to look forward to Totally Naked, or I'm going to look forward to Dancing Man.
Yeah.
And in the fall, I'll drink Staghorn. And that's, you know, that's that ritual, I think, is important to, maybe it's kind of what you're driving at.
Yeah.
That idea of the ritual of being grounded, is very important to the, our sense of security as humans.
I suppose so. There's probably something deeper and psychological going on with
definitely
me here.
Definitely is. Definitely is. We are somewhat a compulsive species for sure.
So, and I'm glad you brought up, you know, looking forward to different beers at different times of the year. It's specific to brands. I was just looking forward ahead on the brand calendar. Cause, if you haven't checked it out yet, a new Nuglaris website has been launched, which I'm actually very excited about because I feel it's very user friendly on the mobile device, And I was checking out the brand calendar and I saw Road Slush is going to be making a return.
Yep. We're brewing that right now.
So that's an oatmeal stout, right?
Yes. Yes.
So can you walk me through what the what is an oatmeal stout? Like what makes it an oatmeal stout, I guess? Besides, I guess, the obvious answer of
oatmeal. In addition that it's made with the percentage of oatmeal, and oatmeal can be somewhat creamy, mm-hmm. a little bit oily. It may not be, but it's generally this style of beer is creamy and sweet. It doesn't have to be, certainly. There are lots of breweries that make a more assertive tasting beer, but traditionally oatmeal stouts are... really, it's a English. It comes from England, and the story was that Charles Finkel, who was one of the early importers of European beers, and he ran Marchand du Vin. I've mentioned him before because he got me a job at a brewery in Germany. But he was looking at some old books and Michael Jackson books, and saw a label for an oatmeal stout and thought, oh, that's really interesting. That's cool. So he asked Sam Smith to make him an oatmeal stout to sell in America. And Sam Smith has said, you know, that's kind of a old people beer. No one drinks that. That's kind of esoteric, nothing beer. And
yeah.
They made it for him and it took off really well. So that was inspiration for us to make a malty, rich, creamy, sweet, stout that is different than our coffee stout because it doesn't contain coffee. And so we're brewing it right now and it'll be coming out soon.
Cool. And one of my favorite things is how you sort of rotate the coffee stout and oatmeal stout. So I have something like sort of different to look forward to every winter. And I know you mentioned in the last episode, you say, oh, you know, we don't make that many stouts. There's a lot of good ones out there. And I hear you say something like that often. And I always in the back of my head think like, yeah, but you make one of the best stouts I've had. Oh, well,
thanks. This oatmeal stout's called Road Slush.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I absolutely love... I think whenever I look at Deb's labels, like there are certain ones that are just like touchstones in my head that are like, oh, that's just like a perfect
label. Well, she draws them all by hand. There's no computer. She just freehands them, like Spotted Cow jumping over the state. That she freehanded that.
And just the sort of orange on tan Road Slush label with the car and the road.
Right, it is somewhat iconic.
It's really, really...
And it's a Wisconsin sense of humor.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, you know... Yeah, and I guess what I was just trying to drive at in this episode is just how we crave different things at different times of the season. And, you know, for us here moving into, you know, fall and winter, it is really important to have those different offerings on that sort of match what you're kind of going through in life and,
sure.
and in the outdoors. So,
well, I kind of look at it like if we were a restaurant, we would have a special.
Yeah.
And so these are our specials that we're offering for a limited time. And it's kind of fun. It keeps the it on one hand, it's very inefficient because if you're just kind of kicking out one or two beers, you can be really, really efficient. But when you start making a Doppelbock with a double decoction or throwing a stout that's going to require some black malts being ground separately and put into the lauter tun, all of these things are disruptive to the rhythm of brewing, but we all love the challenge and we love to be experiencing new things.
Well, and I'm sure for you, and you know, one of the things I always hear people talk about with you and Deb will say it basically anytime, you know, we're talking about you and how you think, so Dan's just always thinking. He's like, whether it's he first wakes up or he's going to bed or he's eating lunch, he's always thinking about beer and brewing. So you know, I suppose for a guy like you, anyone's lucky to have two or three core beers that people are just buying and you can make them all
sure,
the time.
Sure.
But if your mind is just sort of crunching this stuff all the time,
it is.
You kind of need to have that outlet.
It's a mental illness. But yes, yeah, you're right.
Wait, you wouldn't want to see what I'm like when I'm not doing this.
Yeah, right.
So, I think we got a little bit of time left for, listener question. And, if you do have any questions, you can email me at smay@newglarusbrewing.com. Any questions for Dan, we'll be glad to get them and read them to Dan. But one that's come up a few times, and especially, you know, considering we're talking about having a brewery-only drop of an Eisbach here in New Glarus coming in the near future, is how, you know...
Probably not in the near future, probably near by this summer, because we gotta let it a bottle ferment for a bottle age for some time before we release it.
Gotcha. So. See, this is why I need to ask you the questions. Yeah, right. I do not know what I'm talking about with this stuff. So, over summer, but during the COVID, during COVID, the brewery had to basically shut down to the public.
Sure.
You guys, you know, did a very good job of keeping everybody safe and separate and everything running and the beer flowing for package out throughout the state. But when we came back, we weren't able to open on the weekends. And we've gotten the question a few different times of, why are we not open on the weekends? And B, when would you foresee us opening on the weekends?
Yeah, that's a good question. And really, this is a more Deb's side of the business, but I can tell you that we don't have any plans, unfortunately, to open on the weekends. I apologize for that. And there are a number of reasons. I guess mainly we are a manufacturer. We're a brewer, and we don't have a restaurant. We don't want to compete with the restaurants in New Glarus, our customers. So we have a gift shop. And a tap room that people can taste beer and walk around the brewery. Simply, frankly, the only reason is we love having customers around. I love seeing people in the brewery. I love talking to them. So it allows us, we don't really do any marketing per se.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, other than this, it's a way for us, for our customers to see us, and there's transparency. There's literally, you know, glass between the production area and the tour area so people can see the brewery. So it is very, very important. However, on the weekends, people want to come to the brewery on the weekend and they want to take it easy.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? So do our customers. I remember Deb came home one day from giving tours at the old brewery some years ago, and someone said, "Do you work on Saturday?" She's like, "I'm working now." "Yeah, but do you work on Saturday?" "I'm here. I'm working." As if giving a tour is sort of like, you know,
yeah,
this is what I'd rather do than be at home. So
I would rather be here than on a couch with a book, yeah, or something.
Exactly, exactly. So my point is that we are a manufacturing business. It's hard to find people that want to work weekends. Mm-hmm. And most people nowadays, since COVID, want to work day shift, and they want to work Monday through Friday.
Yeah.
And they don't want to work on the weekends. So finding people to work on the weekends is very difficult. And when it's crowded, and we used to have many thousands of people here.
Yeah.
And if you don't have enough people working, the lines are long and people become very angry.
And it becomes a bad experience for almost everybody involved.
And, you know, 99% of people are absolutely patient. The most people are just so sweet. But there's always one person who's...
Yeah.
So that's demoralizing. But the issue is simply that we can't find people. So if we put out ads for to hire people for weekend work, it's basically crickets. It's possible to find college students to work during the summer, but generally they want to leave in August, and our busiest time is the fall.
Yeah.
So and then in addition to help in the gift shop, since we have credit card machines and et cetera, you need to have an IT person available, and you need to have a maintenance person because people plug up toilets, et cetera, things happen.
Yeah.
So now you need a supervisor, you need a staff, you need maintenance and IT people to be available, and it becomes somewhat cumbersome. And Deb and I are, you know, we're in our early 60s, and Deb pretty much worked every weekend forever.
Yeah.
And at some point, you know, starts to get taxing.
Yes.
And since we are a manufacturer, we're drilling down and focusing. We live in a world now where things are very uncertain. Prices are skyrocketing. Our raw materials, et cetera. Everything is cattywampus. And therefore, we need to circle the wagons and really concentrate on our core business. And running a weekend gift shop is it's a full time business. It's a big business.
I've been in there pulling beers on a Saturday Sunday.
Sometimes we've called you and said, hey, come in.
We're getting just down swamped. The street. I was like, okay.
Yeah, because we have 15 or 20 people. And then I didn't even mention that also we need a crew to direct people to where to park.
Yeah.
Because the parking lot is full. And everybody wants to park in front of the door, mm-hmm. so they have to be directed to a secondary parking lot, and that requires two or three people out in the parking lot, and they all require training. Now, it sounds like I'm whining, but really my point is it's a business. It's a retail business. We are not retailers. We are brewers.
Yeah.
So I apologize that we're not open on weekends, but I do hope that you come by during the week. Because during the week, we're making beer, the brewers are available, they're happy to talk to you, and there's a lot going on. And if you can find the time to come during the week, that would be wonderful. But it's just not working for us. It's in the modern world, it just doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, and I think to your point about the experience on both sides, if you're not in the position to have it's staffed up to the level it needs to be to run it successfully, then your employees are getting it from your customers, who are then also not having a great experience because they're waiting in lines and things like that.
Exactly.
And it just becomes, well, who is this for, kind of a deal
at
that point. So
pretty much.
Cool. So that'll do it for us. I think we've hit our, about our time here. As always, Dan, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, thank you.